Welcome to episode 28 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today I am talking to Sylvia Borzucki. She is a teaching professor of political science and international relations at Carnegie Mellon University. Sylvia, thank you for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Sylvia's written extensively on social security and health policies in Chile, as well as Chilean politics. She's got a whole long list of publications, one of which actually, or a couple of which, she's co-authored with me. But the main thing for now is that she has a forthcoming book with Palgrave entitled Human Rights Policies in Chile, The Unfinished Struggle for Truth and Justice, 1990 to 2014. And I looked that up. Looks like it's coming out in May, sometime really soon.
Yeah, I think mid-May, that's the date they gave me.
Okay, awesome. Now, but before getting to that, I want to start with the question that I've been asking everyone, and that is, what first got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
Well, first of all, thank you for the interview and having me in the podcast. This is a really great opportunity to talk to you about my interests. As for what got me to study Latin America, here is the story. You know part of it. I was born and raised in Chile, mm-hmm. and we Chileans thought that Chile was the most democratic country in Latin America, the exception to all the rules, and so on and so forth. But that myth ended the day General Pinochet took power, namely September 11, 1973. And what we realized was that in a matter of hours, all the central elements of Chilean democracy had been destroyed. And Chileans were deprived of all the rights and freedoms that they really cherished. I had already moved to the U.S. I moved to the U.S. before the coup, and I was in Pittsburgh. I had then the opportunity to go back to school and get my doctorate degree in political science and Latin American studies at the University of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and I think that it's funny with everybody, there's always a personal connection of some way, but yours is probably the most, even the most central to actually experiencing it. And thinking, though, actually, it's a nice segue, thinking about Chile. So for the people, we got to assume people who are listening to this might, some have background, some might not, but what was the status of both truth and justice, maybe even the difference between the two, in 1990 when the military government left power in Chile?
At that point there isn't much of a distinction because we didn't have much of anything. General Pinochet had conducted a war against Marxism in his view and used this argument to kill and torture thousands of people. But at the end of the regime, all we had was basically anecdotal information about one case or another one, and all of them were strongly denied by the generals, and the answers to any accusations were threats and denials. Moreover, and this is important for, you know, the evolution of this, General Pinochet had passed a law, quote-unquote, a decree in practice, which provided amnesty for him and all his accomplices. So, in brief, we didn't know much of anything.
And so, in your opinion, what are the key successes? I mean, I know this is a long period of time. It's a big question. But what are the key successes that have occurred after 1990?
Sure. So there's been a lot. However, it's been slow and it's been piecemeal. We have to start then with President Elwin, the first democratically elected president. And he established the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. with the charge of finding out how many people had disappeared or been killed by the regime. So what's important about this commission is that it has a very limited scope. It can only investigate death. It cannot investigate torture, has no power to try those who had committed crimes, and could not even name the authors of the disappearances, etc. I had the opportunity to interview President Elwin a few years ago for the book, and he said repeatedly, "I did as much as I could."
Yeah.
Or, "I did as much as the circumstances allowed me," because I had General Pinochet sitting literally across the square from the presidential palace as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and threatening me with all sorts of things if I took any further actions. So what we have to realize then is that for any progress, either in the areas of truth or justice, to occur, General Pinochet's power had to decline. And the opportunity came in 1998. He finished his term as commander-in-chief. He traveled to the UK for business or health, depending on the story. and then he was detained in Spain under an extradition order issued by the Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón, who was conducting trials against the Chilean and the Argentinian military for disappearances of Spanish citizens in those countries. What's interesting about this is that Pinochet's detention opens up a tremendous space in Chile for the activity of the human rights groups that had existed since the early years of the dictatorship, but really had either been repressed during the dictatorship and often, as they told me repeatedly, also ignored by the current president at the time, Mr. Eduardo Frei. So what's going to happen then is that the Frei administration demands that Pinochet is returned to Chile, that he is tried in Chile, not in Spain, if he committed any crimes. And upon his return, while he could not prosecute Pinochet, what he does then is create the so-called Round Table of Human Rights, or the Mesa de Diálogo, a round table, a space for the former military leaders and the human rights activists and leaders and lawyers and church representatives and others to meet and talk about the past. And this roundtable is interesting in that starts with first the denial of the human rights groups of, you know, even accepting the space. There is only one human rights representative there, Pamela Pereira, and she cannot even shake the hands of the army representative. However, at the end of the meeting, they shook hands.
Okay.
And that is seen as, you know, a major sort of symbol in the process. What the military was asked to do at the end of the meetings was to provide a report specifying who had been killed under military control or while imprisoned by the military. And they provided this report to the next president, President Lagos, And they brought to him a report that said that about 180 people had been killed, which was, of course, incomplete, to say the least, false. What Lagos did, and I also had the chance of talking to Lagos about these and other things, was to give it immediately to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, asking him to designate special judges to investigate the disappearances listed in the military report. Well, you have a tremendous reaction to all of this. The human rights groups arguing that the report is incomplete, that there is so much more to be done, and the judges began then their work. Is that making sense?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. So then, would you say that then is the key success is breaking through to have more investigations than there had been in the past?
Exactly. So let's turn now to the question of justice, because this is all about finding a little bit of the truth, right? So
right.
Nothing much has happened in the area of justice because of the amnesty law. The way in which the Chilean courts understood the amnesty law originally was that they could not even investigate, let alone prosecute, because this law provided such a blanket protection to the military. But by 1998, 2000, there's going to be a new generation of judges, and they're going to begin to start thinking differently about this amnesty decree. And the most important of those is Judge Juan Guzmán, who read the law carefully and said, here is a huge loophole. The law protects the military from homicide, but not from kidnapping. And in fact, what we have here is not a homicide because the body has never been seen or returned, but what we have is what he called prolonged kidnapping, which was not protected by the amnesty law.
Right, right.
So he's putting the military, as you can see, between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
The military could be protected by the amnesty law if they return the bodies, which would be an admission of criminal behavior, right?
Right, right.
On the other hand, if they didn't return the bodies because they didn't have them, or they didn't know where they were, or whatever other reason they might have, then the protections of the amnesty law didn't apply.
Right.
And Guzmán then is able to start literally dozens of prosecutions, and he goes on to discovering mass burials or places where you have numbers of people being buried. And he also began to hear about those who have been buried first and then under orders from Pinochet removed and thrown into the ocean and as their ultimate burial place.
Right. And you say, quoting, is that that while there has been this progress that you've been just discussing, that it's, while it's applauded by some because of what has been done, has been entirely unsatisfactory to many because it has provided only partial versions of the events, it has left many critical questions unanswered, and it has not provided enough justice to the victims. Would you say, is that because of the amnesty? Or how would you explain why that's the case?
Yes, here are the explanations, and also two more events that are important to keep in mind before we go into that. The commotion produced by all of these around 2000 led President Lagos to form yet another commission, but this one you're only to investigate imprisonment and torture. Mm-hmm. It's known as the Balek Commission, led by a very well-known leader of the Chilean Catholic Church, Monsignor Balek. What the Balek Commission unveiled was that about 30,000 people had been illegally imprisoned and tortured. Many believed that this was incomplete, and President Bachelet, after Lagos, ordered the reopening of these investigations and came to the conclusion, after seeing the results of both commissions, that about 38,000 people had actually been tortured by the regime.
Right.
So, back to your question, the way in which I see these policies, and while I think why I think they're so unsatisfactory is this. They are policies. They are product of political compromises. Much like any other policies, they depend on the configuration of political forces at any given time. Who's in power? What's the power of the human rights groups, the political parties, Congress, the president, etc. And those compromises then become very insufficient. So when I talk to representatives of the human rights community, they would say those compromises are just another form of impunity. Mm-hmm. They don't go far enough. They don't do enough. A good example of this is that presidents, while creating commissions to investigate the truth, at the same time present or introduce to Congress full stop laws to stop the trials. Mm-hmm. So you see them trying to have a balance then, or achieve a balance between I'll give them the truth, but justice damages the military, and I want to stop that.
Right.
And
right.
I think from my interviews, I got a pretty clear idea that that's what they had in mind. So the human rights groups think that not enough has been done, but if you turn to the other side, there are many in Chile who believe that General Pinochet saved the country from Marxism and a bunch of other things. And as a result, there should be no trials. The past should not be revisited unless it is to honor the past and the dictator. And it's very hard then to find any kind of common point between these two groups.
Right. And you also write that the truth, quote-unquote, the truth has been offered as compensation for lack of justice. Is this a conscious policy of the Concertación, or now the Nueva Mayoría? They were in power for so long. Were they consciously just giving sort of the truth as, you know, with investigations to compensate for the fact that they were not going to push for more justice?
My impression is, yes, the Concertación wanted to really appear as if it was doing a whole lot in the human rights area, particularly certain presidents or leaders, but at the same time, that was limited to investigating the truth. So Lagos, for instance, is a great example of this. He creates the Balek Commission to investigate torture. At the same time, he introduces a full stop law to Congress, which was never approved. But nevertheless, it was, you know, his proposal.
Right.
And at the same time, at least in the interview and in other places, he was terribly critical of what Judge Guzman was doing. He thought that it was a shame or shameful for the country that the military had to quote-unquote parade in front of his office or in the tribunals. So I think, yes, the answer is this was a conscious policy, and it allowed the Concertación to buy enough time and to survive for as long as it did.
So would you say, because I was thinking too, my next question was, you know, what are the current obstacles to more justice? Because you think Bachelet, you would think, well, she actually suffered under the military government. Why doesn't she push harder? Is it because she's afraid it will hurt her own coalition?
I think so. It's really interesting what I discovered researching this, and it refers to Bachelet, and we both know that she was a victim of torture, that her father died after being tortured.
Right.
And at the same time, she was promoting military officers who had been active either in DINA, the security agency doing most of the torturing, or the successor of DINA. And she had no trouble promoting these people to generals and commanders and so on and so forth. This was disclosed actually during the Piñera presidency, and is seen as a way for the Concertación to placate the military, and Bachelet was very much part of that.
Right. Yeah, so that the political survival of the coalition actually then becomes more important than anything else.
I totally agree.
And now last question is thinking more specifically about your book. What other key conclusions do you draw that you would want to note from your book?
Thanks, Greg. Couple of things to conclude. I think the truth policies, the discovery of what happened, has been very important, even if it's partial, because it acknowledges the past. It has provided reparations to the victims. They are not very large, but at least there is some help, and the reparations go to the victims or their families. They have received apologies, and they have been memorialized all throughout Chile. And this was a policy of both the Lagos and the Bachelet administration.
Okay.
As for justice, I'm going to give you a couple of numbers here. As of December of 2015, 10% of those killed by the military and 2% of those tortured had obtained justice. So 10%, 2%.
Yeah.
That gives you a scope then, a sense of how much justice has been achieved. Only 344 military officers have received sentences, and of those, 163 are currently serving time in prison. So I think that says it all in terms of justice. My final thoughts are about reconciliation. I think we often ask societies to reconcile, and we ask, you know, from human rights policies to be the instrument for reconciliation. And my sense is that that is just so unfair, that this is just another burden for the victims, that they had to admit to the abuse, they had to come together to a unified memory, and memories cannot be unified. You have yours, I have mine. The people who suffer, you know, have very different memories from the generals who were, you know, doing their job, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm, right.
So it seems to me that we need to think in terms of not necessarily reconciliation, but accepting that we all have very different memories and views of the past.
Yep, that is definitely true. And so we're now out of time. I've been talking to Sylvia Brzezinski, who is teaching professor of political science and international relations at Carnegie Mellon University. And Sylvia, thank you so much again.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.